Surely they didn't think we were coming next week. Remember, we originally told them it would be next week. Maybe somehow they got confused and the cleaning hasn't been done yet. Her voice trailed off. She was trying, but he wasn't buying. Just wait till he got hold of Marion's husband, Sam, the senior warden. He had had a round or two with senior wardens in his time. He was no babe in the woods when it came to what's what with senior wardens. The phone. There must be a phone around here. We could call the field walkers. Shine the light around. They found a wall phone on the other side of the cabinets, but the line was dead. The bedrooms, she said, desperate. At the end of the hallway, which was covered by a Persian runner, they found a cavernous bedroom and surveyed it with the flashlight. Closet doors standing agape, windows open, curtains blowing. The bed made, but sopping wet. This can't be right. They wouldn't do this to us. He could tell his wife was teetering on the edge of hysteria. Wait till I get my hands on that fine bishop of yours who would send you out to some uninhabited wasteland after the years of faithful service you've given him. That vainglorious dog. Nothing personal, he told Barnabas, who was sniffing the closets. Because they hadn't known what else to do at nearly midnight on a strange, dark island with no lights and no phone, they made the double bed in the guest room and got in it, Barnabas on the floor on one side and Violet in her open crate on the other, where his inconsolable wife sighed and fumed herself to sleep as he lay staring at the pale circle cast by the flashlight onto the ceiling, muttering words and thinking thoughts he never dreamed he would say or think, and feeling distinctly waterlogged, even in a perfectly dry pair of pajamas from his bureau in Mitford, thanks be to God for small favors. He sat up in bed, dazed. Where in heaven's name? Barnabas barked wildly, and someone was knocking on a door. As the room came into focus, he remembered the predicament they were in, and counted it odd that one should wake to, rather than from, a nightmare. He glanced at his watch, 7 o'clock, and bolted into the hallway without robe or slippers. He padded through the dark paneled living room and opened the door, feeling anger rise in him again. "Father? Father Cavanaugh?" "Yes," he snapped, buttoning his pajama top. "Sam Fieldwalker, sir, your senior warden." The tall, gentle-looking man appeared deeply puzzled. "Sam?" He shook hands as Barnabas sniffed the stranger's shoes. "We saw your car out front, and, well, you see, we waited for you and Miss Cavanaugh till 11 o'clock last night." "Waited? Where?" "Well, in your cottage, over there." He pointed off the porch. "You mean this isn't our cottage?" "Well, no, I'm terribly sorry. I don't know how. Well, it must have been the storm and no lights to see by." "The wrong cottage!" shouted his wife, peering around the hall door in her nightgown. "Thanks be to God!" "This is Love Cottage, owned by the Redmond Love family, who started coming here in the 40s. Gracious sakes, Father, Miss Cavanaugh, I can't begin to tell you how sorry." He thought Sam Fieldwalker might burst into tears. "Oh, no, please," he said. I don't know how we could have thought for a moment. Well, you see, it was dark as pitch, and we couldn't find the street sign in the hedge, the one Marion told us to look for." "Ah, now I'm getting a clear picture." Sam brightened considerably. "You turned into the Love's old driveway, which is wide enough to look like a street. Property wasn't so dear in the 40s. And, of course, there's an overgrown hedge bordering their property as well." "Oh, I'm sure Marion never thought of that." "Well, no harm done. We're glad the mystery is solved. But do the Loves always leave their house unlocked?" "Hardly anyone on Whitecap locks their doors. And, of course, the Love children and their kids come and go during the summer, though not so much any more." "Aha!" The sunlight was dazzling. His glasses were by the bed, and he was squinting like a monk at vespers. "Well, let me help you move your things, Father. Marion's waiting over at Dove Cottage to show you around and cook your breakfast. She's baking biscuits, and she's found some nice fresh perch, if that's all right." At that moment, Father Tim heard his stomach rumble, and at the thought of Marion Fieldwalker's fresh perch and biscuits, he felt close to tears himself. Sam's wife, Marion, met them on the porch of Dove Cottage. "We waited till 11. Then when you didn't come, we thought the storm had held you up and you'd stayed somewhere for the night," said Marion, showing them inside. "What do you think about your kitchen?" asked Sam. He was a tad embarrassed to see tears brimming in his wife's eyes. "It's too beautiful for words," she said. "We couldn't like it better." If last night had been a nightmare, this was a dream come true. The sun streamed through a sparkling bay window and splashed across the broad window seat. Bare hardwood floors shone under a fresh coat of wax. "One of our parishioners bought this cottage a few months ago and had it completely redone," said Sam. "Otis Bragg, you'll meet him tonight. Otis and his wife offered it to the parish for the new interim." "You see just there," Marion pointed out the window, "that patch of blue between the dunes? That's the ocean." She proclaimed this as if the ocean belonged to her personally, and she was thrilled to share it. "Well, come and have your breakfast," said Sam, holding the chair for Cynthia. On a round table laid with a neat cloth, they saw a blue vase of watermelon-colored crepe myrtle, and the result of Marion Fieldwalker's labors. Fried perch, crisp and hot on a platter. A pot of coffee, strong and fragrant. A pitcher of fresh orange juice. Cantaloupe cut into thick, ripe slices. Biscuits mounded in a basket next to a golden round of cheese and a saucer of butter, with a school of jellies and preserves on the side. "What a generous parish you are," said Father Tim, "and God bless you for it." Marion smiled. "We've always tried to spoil our priests." Marion insisted on cleaning up the kitchen while they sat around the table, idle as jackdaws. "You're welcome at the library any time," she said, pouring everyone a last cup of coffee, "as long as it's Monday, Wednesday, or Saturday from 9 till 4. "We'll drop in next week," said Father Tim. "And that reminds me, how's the bookstore? I hear you have a small bookstore on the island." Marion laughed. "Well, it's mostly used paperbacks of Ernie's favorite author, Louis L'Amour." "Ernie doesn't sell anything he hasn't read first and totally approves." Sam's eyes twinkled. "I hope you like westerns. You'll pass Ernie's every morning as you walk to church. It's right up the road." "Sounds like the place to be," said Father Tim. "Ernie has his quarters on one side of the building. Mona has hers on the other. Fact is, they've got a yellow line painted down the center of the hall between their enterprises, and neither one steps over it except to conduct business." Sam stirred cream into his coffee, chuckling. "Ernie likes to say that yellow line saved their marriage." "So how do we get to St. John's? I'm longing to have a look." "Good gracious alive," said Sam, digging in his pockets. "I nearly forgot I've got a key right here for you." He fetched out the key and handed it over. "Oh, and Father, there are a couple of envelopes on the table in your sitting room, from two of our most outspoken parishioners. They wanted to get to you before anyone else does, if you understand." "Oh, I do," said Father Tim. "If I were you, Father," Marion warned, "I'd visit the church and take a nice nap before you go reading those letters. To put it plainly, they're all about bickering. We hate to tell you, but our little church has been bickering about everything from the prayer book to the pew bulletins for months on end, and I've heard enough bickering to last a lifetime." Setting off to his new church with his good dog made him feel reborn. A light breeze stole off the water, and the purity of the storm-cleansed air was tonic, invigorating. He thought he heard someone whistling, and was amazed to find it was himself. They cantered along the narrow lane, spying the much-talked-about street sign at the corner of the high fence. The fence was thickly massed with flowering vines and overhung by trees he couldn't identify. It was wonderful to see things he couldn't identify. Why hadn't he been more of a traveler in his life? Why had he clung to Mitford like moss to a log, denying himself the singular pleasures of the unfamiliar? He had the odd sense he was being watched. He stopped in the middle of the street and looked around. Not a bicycle, not a car, not a soul, only a gull swooping above them. They might have been dropped into Eden, as lone as Adam. Ernie's and Mona's, he discovered, sat close to the street, with a dozen or so vehicles parallel parked in front. Cars and pickups lined the side of the road. Mona's Cafe, 3 square meals, 6 days a week, closed Sunday. Ernie's Books, Bait and Tackle, 6 till 6, no Sundays. 12:30, according to his watch, and more than 5 whole hours of freedom lying ahead. Hallelujah! He tied the red leash to a bench, and Barnabas crawled under it, panting. As the screen door slapped behind him, he saw the yellow-painted line running from front to back of the center hallway. A sign on an easel displayed 2 arrows, one pointed left to Mona's, one pointed right to Ernie's. He read the handwritten message posted next to the cafe's screen door. Don't even think about cussing in here. Should he follow the seductive aromas wafting from Mona's kitchen, or buy a white-cap reader and see what was what? He hooked to right, where the bait and tackle shop had posted its own message by the door. A fishing rod is a stick with a hook at one end and a fool at the other. Samuel Johnson. What can I do for you? A large, genial-looking man in a ball cap sat behind the cash register. "Looking for a copy of The White Cap Reader," he said, taking change from his pocket. "Oh, we probably got one around here somewhere. You wouldn't want to pay good money today, since a new one comes out Monday. Roanoke, we got a paper over there?" Roanoke looked up, squinting. "Junior's got it. He took it to the toilet with him." "Oh, that's okay," said Father Tim. "I'll pay for one. How much?" 50 cents. You can get it out of the rack over there at the door." He doled out 2 quarters. "We thank you. This your first time on Whitecap?" "My wife and I just moved here." "Well, now." The man extended a large hand across the counter. "Ernie Fulcher. I run this joint." "Tim Cavanaugh." "What business are you in?" "New priest at St. John's." "Oh, I never set eyes on the old one," said Ernie. "I think Roanoke run into him a time or two." Roanoke nodded, unsmiling. He thought Roanoke's weathered, wrinkled face resembled an apple that had lain too long in the sun. "Well, thanks. See you again." "Right, you stop in any time, you hear?" He loved it at once. St. John's in the Grove sat on a hummock in a bosque of live oaks, which cast a cool, impenetrable shade over the churchyard and dappled the green front doors. He stood at the foot of the steps, inhaling the new smells of his new church, set like a gem into the heart of his new parish. St. John's winsome charm and grace made him feel right at home, expectant as a child. He crossed himself and prayed, aloud and spontaneous in his thanksgiving. "Thank you, Lord, what a blessing, and what a challenge. Give me patience, Father, for all that lies ahead. And especially, I ask for your healing grace in the body of St. John's." He walked up the steps and inserted the key into the lock. It turned smoothly, which was a credit to the junior warden. Then he put his hand on the knob and opened the door. Though heavy, it swung open easily. He liked a well-oiled church door. No creaking and groaning for him, thank you. He walked into the center aisle, which revealed bare, heart-of-pine floorboards. They were more than a hand's breadth wide and creaked pleasantly under his tread. Creaking doors, no, he thought, but floorboards are another matter. He had never lived in a house in which at least 2 or 3 floorboards didn't give forth a companionable creak. On either side of the broad aisle, 8 long oak pews seating 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 4 short pews seating 4. Here and there, a cushion lay crumpled in a pew, reserving that site as someone's rightful, possibly long-term territory. His eye followed the aisle to the sanctuary, where a cross made of ship's timbers hung beneath an impressive stained glass. In the dimly illumined glass, the figure of Christ stood alone with his hands outstretched to whoever might walk this aisle. Behind him, a cerulean sea. Above, an azure sky and a white gull. The simplicity and earnestness of the image took his breath away. "Come unto me," he read aloud from the familiar scripture etched on the window in Old English script. "All ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." These were his first spoken words in his new church. Suddenly feeling the weariness under the joy, he slipped into a pew on the gospel side and sank to his knees, giving thanks. That evening, Father Tim and Cynthia attended a party at Otis and Marlene Bragg's house, a welcoming party in their honor. Marlene was an intense woman with long fuchsia nails, a serious tan, and a great mane of blonde hair with dark roots. "We're real glad to have you and your wife, and you brought your cool weather with you." He smiled at their hostess who had just toured him through her home. "Actually," he said, "I believe I did feel a mountain breeze this morning." "It's usually awful hot this time of year." "I've heard that," he said, "but I know you'll love it on Whitecap just like we do." "Have you been on Whitecap long?" 17 years. "We're from Moorhead City. My husband has worked very hard, Father, to make a name for himself in this area." She pursed her mouth. "He's been mighty generous with the diocese, not to mention St. John's." "I'm sure," she smiled. "And we'd like to keep it that way." A child who appeared to be around 3 years old was making a beeline toward him with no adult in hot pursuit. "Who in the world is this?" asked Father Tim. "This is Jonathan Tolson," beamed a long-time parishioner. Jonathan fell against Father Tim's legs and clasped them tight, gazing up as if they were old acquaintances. He squatted down and took the youngster's hands in his. "Hey, Buddy Rowe." The blonde toddler sucked his lower lip and gazed steadily at him with blue, inquisitive eyes. Then he turned and raced back the way he'd come. The parishioner looked pleased as punch. "He just wanted to tell you hello."
Whitecap Island loosely duplicated the shape of a Christmas stocking with a toe full of nuts and candy. In the toe, Otis Bragg had stationed an extensive system of gravel, rock, and crushed oyster shell inventories, custom cement facilities, and sprawling hangars of grading and construction equipment. In the heel, the lighthouse stood comfortably surrounded by a hedge of yaupons, an abandoned corral for wild ponies, and a small museum. The remainder of the island was chiefly comprised of high dunes, white beaches, canals and marshes, maritime forest, and a small village of homes, shops, inns, and restaurants woven together by narrow lanes. The 35 acres on which St. John's in the Grove sat was located at the top of the stocking. Increasingly, Whitecap attracted tourists from as far away as Canada and California, swelling the ranks of island churches every summer. While many churches on the mainland cranked down, the churches on Whitecap cranked up, both in numbers and activities. Even so, a carefree sense of remoteness insinuated itself almost everywhere. Early on, St. John's new interim learned that island culture made Mitford look like a beehive of cosmopolitan activity. Time seemed to pass more slowly on Whitecap, and then, even with a calendar, a watch, a phone, and a fax machine, the days began to blend into one another like watercolors. Still, there was a lot of work for the new interim to do, like hiring a new organist. Since he had come to Whitecap, his parishioners had given him an earful about the uncaring, self-centered, musically gifted choir director who abandoned his wife and children 4 months ago for St. John's married organist. Speaking of Jeffrey Tolson, a parishioner had quoted John Ruskin, "When a man's wrapped up in himself, he makes a pretty small package." He had frequently prayed for Jeffrey Tolson, but was unable to dismiss the hardness of heart he often felt when doing it. And though he had never laid eyes on St. John's former choir director, he knew precisely who it was when the tall, blonde Scandinavian walked into the church office from the side door. "Jeffrey Tolson," said his caller. He stood by the desk, arms crossed. He couldn't help but notice that Jeffrey Tolson wore leather clogs and a full-sleeved white shirt in the manner of 18th-century poets. "Jeffrey?" "Lord, give me the words, the wisdom, the heart for this," he thought. "Your will be done." "I won't take much of your time." He wanted to say, "My time is yours," but he could not. It was what he always liked to say to parishioners, no matter what the time constraints. Jeffrey Tolson removed his billfold from a rear pocket. "I'm back in Whitecap for a few days. I wanted Jeanette to have this." He withdrew a $100 bill and handed it to Father Tim. "You can't give it to Jeanette yourself? She's in no mood to deal with me." He looked at the money and had a fleeting vision of punching Jeffrey Tolson in the nose, squarely, no holds barred. Gone 4 months, and this was the only offering? "I'll see that she gets it." "I know you think hard of me, Father. Most people do. But Jeanette was no angel to live with. Moody, depressed, demanding. I'm a sensitive man, Father. It was like living with a wet blanket." "Aha. And how was it living with those children of yours?" Jeffrey Tolson's face was suddenly hard. "Don't preach to me." "Far from it, Mr. Tolson." His heart was pounding, his mouth dry, as he stood facing the man who had brought hurt and anger into the midst of St. John's. Jeffrey Tolson turned and stomped from the office. He jerked open the door to the outside steps, then slammed it behind him. At 7 a.m., the day was already sultry. Forecasts were for 99 degrees by noon. He broke a sweat before he reached Mona's Cafe, where he found Ernie paying for a sausage biscuit and a cup of coffee at his wife's cash register. "I'm only allowed over the yellow line as a paying customer," said the genial proprietor from next door. "Get your order and come on over to my side. Chew the fat a while." "This yellow line," said Father Tim, stepping over it, "it must be a real conversation piece." "Well, thing was, Mona kept nosing around my side, saying old books wouldn't pay the light bill. Then I'd go over to her side raising Cain, 'cause she hadn't hiked her prices in 4 years. We nearly ended up in divorce court. We had to learn to mind our own business, you might say. Thing is, I've come to believe all married people ought to have a yellow line of some kind or another." Ernie held the screen door open to books, bait, and tackle. "Welcome to where the elite meet to eat. Boys, watch your language. Preacher Cavanaugh's going to join us this morning." "Tim," he said, nodding to the assembly. "Call me Tim." Ernie launched into his sausage biscuit with considerable gusto. "Seen your neighbor yet? Guess I ought to say hurt him is more like it. What neighbor is that?" "Morris Love, the one behind the hedge." "Well, I didn't know there was one behind the hedge." "You didn't?" Ernie looked incredulous. "Seemed like somebody would have told you." He waited for Ernie to elaborate, but he didn't. "Well, maybe you could tell me." Well, it's what's left of the Love family is what it is. See, there was a whole clan of Loves at one time. Redmond Love, the granddaddy, bought that big tract of land up the road where you're at, built him a fine house in there and put a wall around it. Then he planted a hedge both sides of the wall. It's growed up like a jungle in the last 20 years or so. Father Tim looked at his watch. He'd better get a move on. The Love House was the finest thing on any of these islands, a real mansion. But you can't see it back there unless you're looking for it. Mr. Redmond had somebody come in from upstate New York and make him a tropical garden. Had palm trees and monkeys and I don't know what all. Monkeys? Well, there ain't any monkeys in there now, but used to be. I used to hear 'em when I was a kid. Ernie paused and gave a loud rendition of what it might be supposed was the call of a monkey. Like that, said Ernie. Father Tim nodded, impressed. Used to be macaws in there, too. Some said elephants, but I never went for that. Pretty far-fetched, agreed Father Tim, rolling up his newspaper and putting it under his arm. Anyway, the whole clan built around the mansion. You're living up from the place his second grandson used till, oh, I don't know, maybe 2-3 years ago. Then they pretty much stopped coming. Right. So what about this fellow who lives behind the wall? Ernie looked at him soberly. He's real peculiar. Never leaves his house that I know of, but I wouldn't say nothing to your wife about it. Really? Well, no use to make her worry. The screen door slammed behind two fishermen. While one examined sinkers and knives, the other ordered bait. Let's see, we need a 1/2 pound of shrimp, 12 blood worms, 1 pound of squid. Better make that 1.5 pounds. Well, catch you later, Tim, said Ernie. You come again any time, you hear? Hot. Hotter than hot. He walked into Dove Cottage, thankful for the fan whirring in the living room, and was greeted by his dog bounding down the hallway, pursued by a youngster. Well, look who's here, he said. Jonathan, said Jonathan Tolson. Cynthia appeared from the kitchen. Jonathan's come to spend the day with us. I didn't think you'd mind having company. We can go bike riding Saturday. Right. Your dog, said Jonathan, hugging Barnabas around the neck. My dog. Right. Any dog of mine is a dog of yours. He squatted down and met the blue-eyed gaze of their blonde-haired visitor. I went to visit Jonathan's mommy this morning, and she wasn't feeling well, so Cynthia took her husband's hand and pulled him along the hall to the kitchen. She spoke in a low voice. Jeanette's terribly depressed. She doesn't want to get out of bed. I went to check on her this morning. I'm not sure Jonathan had been fed recently. He just devoured a whole plate of cheese and crackers. Thank heaven I had milk. What about the other children? Gone across to cousins. She said they didn't have room for Jonathan. Apparently Jeanette hasn't been working for some time. She takes in sewing, you know. Dear Lord, he murmured. Soon after arriving in Whitecap, he had recommended medical help for Jeanette Tolson, but she refused, assuring him she'd be fine. He had seen the emptiness in her gaze, heard it in her voice, and knew she was in trouble. I'll be back, he said, kissing his wife. The children, he said, sitting by Jeanette Tolson's bed. I don't care, she whispered. God cares. He's with you in this. She turned her head slowly and looked at him, disbelieving. I promise, he told her. She closed her eyes, and the tears seeped from under her lashes. Let me pray for you, he said. He put the palm of his hand against her forehead, and with his other hand held hers. Lying awake after midnight, he felt the humidity weighing upon them like a blanket. He also felt what he had been dismissing for weeks. He was homesick. He was homesick for Mitford and his boy and Harley, for all the countless components that made his mountain village home. Whitecap had its charms, of course. There was a great deal to be said for the smaller parish, not to mention the general ease induced by sunshine, salt air, and surf. In times past, hadn't doctors prescribed the seashore as a cure-all for nearly anything that ailed? But he wasn't ailing, and he didn't need curing. He believed he was making progress in putting the parish into less quarrelsome order. Several rifts had been healed, and he had ignored the petty issues which, he wasn't surprised, were fading away for want of being nursed. Better still, he saw his wife finding some repose and freedom of spirit after years of toiling like a Trojan. Yes, she had begun the new book, but overall he saw her rested, tanned, vibrant, and flourishing like a kid at summer camp. Last, and certainly not least, St. John's had fallen in love with Cynthia Cavanaugh, and freely said as much. She stood with him in the churchyard every Sunday after services, giving and receiving handshakes and hugs, and serving in several parish trenches, including the nursery, like paid help. In Mitford, he had felt tethered, tethered to Lord's Chapel, tethered to the rectory, tethered to the little yellow house. Here he felt as if he were falling into space, tethered only to God. He got up and walked down the steps to the garden, restless and excited, like a child who wakes in the night, filled with fervent dreams. He saw a shooting star plummet toward the silhouette of an oceanfront cottage and vanish. And then he heard the music. He turned, thinking that somehow a radio had come on in the house. But the music wasn't coming from the house. Though distant, he could hear each note clearly, and perhaps because the piece was familiar, was free to hear beneath the notes the terrible urgency of the music behind the hidden wall, under the full and looming moon. He crept back to bed, thinking of Elaine Pringle and the faint piano music that had floated out on Mitford's night air. He shivered in the breeze that came suddenly from the water and blew through their open windows. Sometime before dawn, he felt the bed move near his feet and thought it was Barnabas. It was Jonathan Tolson. The boy crept toward the head of the bed, silent, and found a place between them. Father Tim heard him sigh, and then, in a moment, heard the boy's rhythmic breathing and smelled his damp, tousled hair. He prayed for Jeanette and for today's mission before he drifted again to sleep. Jeanette Tolson wept all the way across the bridge to the hospital 14 miles away. He sat with her through the admission to the psychiatric floor, explaining to the clerk there was no insurance, and giving his word the bill would be taken care of. How, he didn't know. That would be God's job. He waited until her doctor arrived, and she was settled in a shared room. Reluctantly, she let go of his hand as he left. "Jonathan?" "Don't worry," he said. At 6 a.m., he tried to think of one good reason to spend a full day at the church office, but couldn't. Didn't clergy usually take 2 days every single week? And hadn't he taken only one since arriving? He would go in after lunch. That was the ticket. "Wonderful, darling. You can help me feed Jonathan." His wife had a positively wicked gleam in her eye. "No, I don't like it." Jonathan shook his head vigorously when a bowl of cereal was set before him. Cynthia proffered buttered toast. "No," said Jonathan. "No toast." "What about if we put jelly on it?" asked Father Tim. "I've tried that," she said. It doesn't work. We go through this every morning while you trot down the street whistling. Oh, Timothy, I don't know how to make children eat things they don't like. Why did children keep turning up on his doorstep? Not that he was complaining, but wasn't it odd that he had lived a full 6 decades with hardly a youngster in his life except those he encountered in Sunday school? But then look what it had gained him after all. Dooley Barlow, one of the greatest gifts, most of the time, that had ever come down from the Father of Lights, as St. James had put it. He finished typing up the pew bulletin and rang the hospital. Jeanette was down the hall. "Tell her I'll be there tomorrow," he said to the nurse. "Tell her Jonathan's having a wonderful time." He fished the umbrella from the stand by the downstairs door and prepared to head into the downpour. "Father Cavanaugh, is that you?" He spun around. "Good heavens! Oh, I frightened you, Father. I'm sorry as can be." "Mercy," he said, not knowing what else to say. A tall, thin, stooped woman in a dripping hat and raincoat stood before him, her glasses sliding off her wet nose. "I came in through the front door and couldn't find a soul, so I helped myself to these stairs. I'm Ella Bridgewater, come to audition for the organist position." He was addled. "But I thought tomorrow. I wrote down today in my appointment book, Father. I am very precise about such things, and besides, I couldn't have done it tomorrow anyway, 'cause I'm going to see my niece. I always do that on Saturday, so I would never have—" Of course, my mistake, I'm sure. He was very precise about such things as well, but why quibble? "Well, Miss Bridgewater, glad to see you." He took her wet hand and shook it heartily, noting that she appeared considerably older than her letter stated. "Ella, I gather that you live on Dorster Island. I hear it's lovely over there, quite remote." "Oh, remote isn't the word for it. I drove 10 miles from my little coop by the sea, went over the causeway, came down Highway 20 for 15 miles, took the bridge to Whitecap, and drove to St. John's at the north end. Oh, it's a trek and a half." She patted her chest. "I have the music under my coat." "Well, excellent. We'll just pop upstairs and have at it. Thanks for coming out in this downpour." He followed her up the stairs to the sacristy, where she removed her raincoat and hung it on a peg. She was certainly agile, he thought, and 70 if she was a day. Her letter, however, had said 62 and added, "in vibrant good health." She went briskly up the aisle, clutching her manila envelope, and made short work of the stairs to the loft. "Well, here goes," she said in a loud voice. The old organ nearly blasted him out of the pew. Aha! It was a Bach prelude and fugue, and Ella Bridgewater was giving it everything she had. "How was that, Father?" He stood and faced the loft and clapped with some enthusiasm. Huffing slightly and clutching her envelope, she was down the stairs, along the aisle, and standing by his pew in a trice. "Well done, Miss Bridgewater." "Call me Ella," she said. "Ella, if we can agree on your compensation, I think you may be just the ticket for St. John's." Tears sprang to her eyes.
"Do you really think so?"
"I do." "But," she said, regaining her composure, "you'll have to run it by the vestry." "Right, I intend to."
"Well, when might that be?"
"Wednesday. I'll get back to you right after the meeting. Shouldn't be any problem at all." Miss Bridgewater adjusted her glasses and peered at him.
"And when would I begin, if...
"Sunday after next, I should think."
"Well," she said, beaming. "Well."
Jonathan had wanted his mother tonight. The boy's tears called up a few of his very own. He thought it must be agony to be small and helpless with no mother, no father, no brother or sister to be found. He held Jonathan against his chest, over his heart, and let the boy sob until he exhausted his grief. He walked with him through the house in a five-room circle, crooning snatches of hymns, small prayers and benedictions, and fragments of stories about Pooh and Toad and that pesky rabbit Peter. He didn't know what to do with the child who was crying out of bewilderment and loss, except to be with him in it. He covered the sleeping boy with a light blanket, praying silently. Then he closed the door and tiptoed down the hall and out to the porch where Cynthia sat waiting, a rain-drugged violet slumbering in her lap. For the first time today, he liked the rain. It was friend and shelter to him, enclosing the porch with a gossamer veil. They watched the distant patch of gray Atlantic turn to platinum in the lingering dusk. "Weary, darling?" she asked, taking his hand. "I am. Don't know why, though. Haven't done much today." "Oh, you do more than you realize. Up at dawn, morning prayer, feed and bathe the boy, help the wife, write the pew bulletin, work on your sermon, hire an organist." "Ha!" He took her hand and kissed it. Of all the earthly consolations, he loved understanding best. Not sympathy, no, that could be deadly, but understanding. It was balm to him, and he had sucked it up like a toad, often denying it to her. "Your book," he asked. "How are you feeling about it?" I don't know why I'm doing another book, when I might have had the lovely freedom to do nothing. I suppose I got excited about being in a new place, the way the light changes and the coming and going of the tide. It spoke to me, and I couldn't help myself." She smiled at him. "You know, Timothy, I think I make books because I don't know what else to do."
"You know how to make a ravishing cassoulet."
"Yes, but cassoulet has its limitations. Little books do not." He nodded. "Do you think we'll ever just loll about?" she asked.
"I don't think we're very good at lolling."
She put her head back and closed her eyes. "Thank God for this peace." He heard it first, even through the loud whisper of rain. It was the organ music of their neighbor. He sat up, alert, and cupped his hand to his ear. "What is it, Timothy?"
"It's our neighbor, Morris Love, in the house behind the wall. Listen."
They sat silent for long moments. "Wondrous," she said quietly. The rain seemed to abate out of respect for the music, and they began to hear the notes more clearly. "Name that tune," she said. "Jesus, My Joy, a Bach chorale prelude." He couldn't help but hear the urgency, in truth, a kind of fury underlying the music. He told her what he knew about Morris Love, leaving out Ernie's references to their neighbor's peculiarity.
"Is Mr. Love a concert organist?"
"Not unless you consider this a private concert for the Kavanaughs."
"What a lovely thought," she said, pleased. When the phone rang, he fumbled for it. For a moment, he was at home in Mitford and expected to find it next to the bed. But blast, he was in Whitecap, and the phone was across the room. It rang again. He bumped into the chair and tried to figure what time it was. The rain had stopped, and a stiff breeze blew through the windows. As the phone continued to ring, he picked up his watch and glanced at the glowing dial. 12:40. Not good. Lord, have mercy.
"Hello? I have a collect call from Harley Welch," said an operator. "Will you pay for the call?"
"Yes."
"Reverend?"
"Harley?"
His heart hammered.
"Reverend, I hate to tell you this, but they got Dooley in jail."
He called Rodney Underwood, Mitford's chief of police, at once.
"Buster Austin's been asking for trouble for years," said Rodney.
Now he's done gone and stepped in it.
Well, what about Dooley?
Well, Dooley says he gave Buster a ride to get some clothes over at somebody's house where there wasn't anybody home. Dooley said he sat in the truck while Buster took in an empty duffel bag. The boys were going down the road when two of my men pulled him over. See, there was a silent alarm in that house. And it looks like that empty duffel bag was full of money, CDs, liquor. Now, Dooley says he didn't have nothing to do with it, but Buster says he did. Soon's the paperwork's done, I'll drive the boys over to Wesley and take them before the magistrate.
Good Lord, Rodney, what does that mean?
Well, the magistrate's the one signs the arrest warrant, then I'll serve it. I'm going to tell him I think Dooley's innocent. He's never been in any trouble, and we'll see where we go from there. Magistrate, then he'll set bond, and you'll have to talk to a bondsman if you want Dooley out of jail.
Right. I know the bondsman in Wesley. What kind of bond do you think we're talking about?
Well, breaking and entering and larceny is serious business. You might get off for $20,000, maybe $10,000. The Alstons, they'll probably post a property bond, 'cause Buster don't come from fancy circumstances.
He couldn't believe this was happening. It was a nightmare. It was also the ruination of his boy's summer, his last precious days at home. He felt sick in his very gut.
And where do we go from there, Rodney?
Well, the magistrate'll set a court date 2 weeks to 30 days away.
Let me talk with Dooley, if I may.
He felt like a Mack truck was sitting on his chest.
Hey, said Dooley.
Hey yourself, he replied, drawing thin comfort from their old greeting.
I didn't do it. Buster Alston is still the same lying, cheating geek he always was. I should have known better. I picked him up 'cause I thought he was in trouble. I thought maybe his old car was broke down, and I was trying to help. I could kill him. Maybe I will.
I think you did the right thing.
You do?
I do. It was someone you knew, you thought he needed help, and you stopped.
So how come it turned out like this?
He could hear the barely controlled rage in the boy's voice. Sometimes we do good, and it turns out badly. I don't know why. But it definitely doesn't mean we're to stop doing the right thing.
I want to go home, said Dooley.
He sounded exhausted. I got to work tomorrow. Rodney will take you home as soon as the bail issue is settled.
Did you know I'll have to go to court for this stupid mess?
We'll cross that bridge when we get to it, son. I'm sorry this happened. I wish we were there. God bless you. Everything's going to be fine. I'll call the bondsman as soon as I hear back from Rodney. Now listen, don't be afraid. We love you. He tried to cover all the bases, but his heart felt empty as a gourd. Rodney called at 3 a.m. He had done everything he could to convince the magistrate that Dooley was a good kid with no previous offenses, emphasizing that his daddy was a clergyman. The magistrate said he was a preacher's kid himself, and based on that alone, had a notion to set bail at $40,000. Bottom line, the magistrate was releasing Dooley on a secured $5,000 bond, and Rodney was driving him home as soon as the bondsman could get over to the Wesley jail. Buster Austin's parents had refused to post bond, and Buster would not be going home. He searched his black book and found the number of Ray Porter, the Wesley bondsman.
Ray, Tim Cavanaugh.
My boy's in the Wesley jail, and he's innocent. He's under a $5,000 secured bond. How fast can you get him out of there?
Let me jump in my clothes, said Ray, shaking off sleep. I'll have him out in 20-30 minutes.
God bless you.
I know how it is. I've got two boys,
said Ray Porter, considering that sufficient empathy. Come home. Come home. It went around in his head like a liturgical chant. But how could he go home? As far as he knew, there wasn't a soul who could take Jonathan in. Everybody was working, away for the summer, or too advanced in years to trot after a 3-year-old.
This is home, he said aloud,
but he couldn't force himself to believe it. In truth, he was longing for Mitford,
longing to see his boy and encourage him and cheer him on. Suicidal is what the doctor had said, adding that he had no good idea when Jeanette would be ready to come home. He dialed Jeanette's cousin long distance. No, they really couldn't take Jonathan. It was all they could do to squeeze in Babette and Jason. They were sorry and hoped he understood, which he did. He was definitely into the fray of Whitecap, with back-to-back meetings, hospital treks, and home visitations. He was even pitching in once a week with Cynthia to help tour visitors through the church and grounds. Because of the hither and yonness of it all, he usually took the Mustang. This morning, however, he was walking to church, leaving his dog behind to amuse Jonathan. He heard Jonathan's loud cries from the guest room. The boy definitely wanted his mother. Cynthia nudged him down the steps. "I have story hour at the library this morning. It'll take his mind off things. He'll be fine, dear. Just go." He went, not knowing what else to do. As he passed through the gate into the street, he had the sense once again that someone was watching him. He shaded his eyes and peered toward the hedge-bound, chest-high wall that surrounded his neighbor's house. On impulse, he stepped closer to the hedge and called, "Mr. Love, are you there?" The foliage moved, shook slightly, and was still. What could he lose? If Morris Love was not there, then he was standing here talking to himself. If Morris Love was there, then he was merely being neighborly. "If you're there, Mr. Love, I'd just like to say that we, my wife and I, enjoy your music very much."
"Out! Out!"
The sudden shout through the hedge was loud, hoarse, and furious. Father Tim stepped back, startled.
"Out!"
The command was repeated with even greater ferocity. The voice sent chills up his spine. Yes, indeed, he had done the wrong thing in trying to be neighborly. He trotted quickly down the lane toward Ernie's without looking back. Father Tim checked the answering machine when he came home.
"Father, it's me, Puny."
Puny didn't sound like herself.
"I don't know how to tell you this."
This was definitely his least favorite way for a phone call to begin.
"I just got to your house and realized I'd left the door unlocked for 4 days. How in the world I did a dumb thing like that, I don't know. I am so sorry. But I've looked and looked, and it seems nothing's missing, so I think it's all right. But I know how you count on me to take care of things, and I just hate letting you down on anything."
"It's okay," he said aloud to the machine. He loved that girl like his own flesh. "Don't worry about it."
"I know you sometimes don't lock your doors, but I always do because I'm responsible for things here, and I just hope that... I hope you'll not think hard of me for leaving your door unlocked. I'm probably using up all your tape. But there is some good news. JoJo's been promoted to lieutenant. That's right under the chief. How do you like that?"
He liked it very much indeed. Cynthia waved from the porch. Jonathan and Barnabas were waiting at the gate.
"Look at me,"
said the boy, jumping up and down.
"I'm looking. That's a new shirt.
And new pants."
He opened the gate.
"Where did those snappy new clothes come from, Buddy Rowe?"
"UPS."
"Dearest, where's your hair?" called his wife from the porch.
"I got it cut at Ernie's. What do you think?"
"I love it," she said, sitting down on the top step. His wife was herself wearing something new and boggling. Red shorts, which were plenty short, a strapless white top, and espadrilles. He scratched behind his dog's ears and fairly bounded up the steps. His sermon was finished and walked through, thought for thought, precept upon precept. In the study, Jonathan had paced at his heels to the bookcase, then to the wall with the painting of the Roman Colosseum, back and forth. Exhausted at last, Jonathan fell asleep on the rug where Father Tim stepped over him without missing a beat. The rest of the day lay ahead, shimmering like silk. They would swim in the ocean, they would go out to dinner in their new duds, and tomorrow they'd hear the organ raising its mighty voice to the timbers, thanks to the eager Ella Bridgewater. He felt as young as a curate, as bold as a lion.
Father, Puny, the most awful thing has happened. I don't know how to tell you.
He sank into the office chair, feeling suddenly weary. Just tell me.
Your angel.
My angel?
The one on the mantle. I was running the dust rag downstairs. You know I run the dust rag every time I come because of the work going on in the street. You knew they was relaying pipes, didn't you?
No, I didn't know.
Well, I was running the dust rag and...
It's all right. Whatever you're going to tell me is all right. She was dusting and the angel toppled off the mantle. Big deal, it broke an arm. How bad could it be?
Well, the angel, it's not there anymore. It's gone.
Gone?
I mean, the other day when I called you about the door being unlocked, I looked all around and didn't see nothing missing. I mean, I thought something seemed different about your study, but I couldn't figure out what it was, and I didn't notice anything being gone. So what I'm saying is maybe it was gone last week. I don't know.
Have you talked with Harley? And Puny, stop crying. It's all right. Just sit down, take a deep breath, and tell me everything.
Well, I talked to Harley. He said he hadn't seen nothing going on at your house except me going in and out.
Was anything else missing? Anything moved around?
No, sir, and I promise you, I really looked. I went over the whole house with a fine-tooth comb, even the closets, and checked the windows and basement door. They're tight as a drum. I feel terrible about this, Father. I'll pay for the angel, whatever it costs. I talked to JoJo, and he said we'd pay every cent.
This is a mystery. I remember having a $50 bill and a credit card in my desk. In the drawer on the left, I wonder. I'll go look, she said. Very odd, he mused.
Your money and credit card's in the drawer on the left-hand side.
Odder than odd. I wonder if Dooley would know anything.
I don't think Dooley was in the house a single time.
I'll call him at school and ask. I don't know, Puny. I'm as baffled by this as you are.
I'm real sorry.
It's okay, I promise. We'll figure it out. Don't worry. Just lock up good when you leave. He sat at his desk for some time, occasionally nodding his head, speaking half sentences aloud, and in general, feeling befuddled. They sat on the porch in the gathering twilight and watched Jonathan play with a sand bucket and shovel in their end-of-summer garden. His wife knew absolutely nothing about the angel and was as dumbfounded as he. It was bizarre. It was unreal. "I'll get it," Cynthia said when the phone rang. She dashed inside and came back with the cordless. "Those eggs you gave us last week are wonderful. The yolks are a lovely shade of yellow." Covering the mouthpiece, she whispered, "Penny Duncan from church."
"Oh, really?"
She listened intently. "That's wonderful. Well, how good of you, Penny. How thoughtful." She gazed into the yard at Jonathan. "Oh, he's a handful, all right, but no, thanks so much. We love having him. We're all quite happy together." "Yes, I'm sure, but thank you again. You're very dear, Penny."
"Well, then, love to Marshall. See you in church."
She laid the phone on the arm of the rocker and smiled at him. "You had an offer for help with Jonathan and turned it down?" "Well, she has 10 days of vacation and offered to keep him, but..." She shrugged. "But what?"
"But I declined."
"Why?" he asked. She shrugged again.
"Just
Because.
May I read you something?
I like it when you read, Jeanette whispered.
She sat with him in the cramped space of her semi-private room, looking toward the wall. I asked the Lord for a bunch of fresh flowers, he read. But instead, he gave me an ugly cactus with many thorns. I asked the Lord for some